You remember that we were speaking about the funeral service, and we have now come specifically to the point where the epistle reading, is read as our Holy Church has appointed for every funeral service. Holy Scripture. For the way a person understands a sorrowful event will determine whether he is swallowed up by sorrow or simply grieves, feels pain, and mourns. For as you know, some people fall into such profound sorrow that they even follow those who have fallen asleep into death. We have repeatedly read in the newspapers of people who lost their other half, a husband losing his wife, or a wife her husband, for example, and then died the following day, or even that very same day consumed by sorrow. After Christ, such hopeless sorrow is not permissible. It is not permissible. Tribulations, yes, but hopeless sorrow, no. It becomes a form of idolatry, as the divine John Chrysostom says. And St. Paul says that even a lover of money may be regarded as an idolater. How much more, then, the person who gives himself over to weeping and insists on being consoled and comforted, especially in places where they hire professional mourners, paying women to sing laments and wail. Imagine how idolatrous this is considered to be. Indeed, the divine John Chrysostom went so far as to impose excommunication. For a long period he excluded from the church those who displayed such grief and mourning that they approached the boundaries of unbelief, idolatry, and outright denial of the faith. Thus, both the apostle and the gospel reading in the funeral service contain words that comfort the human person. They set him back in his proper place, showing him exactly where he ought to stand and how he ought to understand the condition of the one who has fallen asleep. The departed does not vanish into oblivion, he is not lost. Yet this satanic expression is constantly heard, even on the lips of Christians. I lost my loved one, I lost my child, I lost my wife, I lost my husband. To say I lost them is blasphemy. Unless it is regarded as ignorance on the person's part and accounted as such, it is blasphemy, even blasphemy unto death, to say, I lost them. God forbid that either you or I should say that we have lost someone dear to us. As though that person were an object, God has used countless means and placed countless things before us to speak about this mystery of death and the resurrection. Whenever we speak of death, our nous, the spiritual intellect, must immediately turn to the resurrection so that we may be comforted. When, according to the language of the world, we say that someone died, we must understand that he is asleep, otherwise we will never be consoled. You remember when our Christ spoke to his disciples about their friend Lazarus. He said, "Our friend has fallen asleep," and they did not understand. "If he is asleep," they said, "he will wake up. Why should we go back there and put ourselves in danger? Did they not try to stone us yesterday? Are we going to return there willingly? We are not going." "Oh, he has died. He has died? Then we should go, since he is dead." The distinction appears at once. God presents the matter in one way, while the unbelieving person presents it in another. The church speaks of those who have fallen asleep. Man speaks of the dead. The church speaks of sleeping places, cemeteries. Man speaks of places of the dead, graveyards. At once, in the most satanic way, the language is chosen so that nothing may remind him of the resurrection. Nothing may remind him that death is temporary, or that one day these graves will be opened. Yet if a person would only consider how, in his love, God has arranged for us to be taught about the resurrection of the human person, besides all that has been written, he would understand that one day, whether we want it or not, whether we believe it or not, we shall rise again. And yet there are so many other examples. Take the sun. Does it not die every evening? And yet it rises again. Is it not buried every evening, and still it rises again? What does this mean? Does it not remind us of anything? And what are winter and spring? Winter is death. Spring is the resurrection. Does the farmer not cast his seed into the ground in autumn, in the mountains? Is it not then covered beneath many feet of snow, sometimes 15, 20, or even 30 feet of snow? That grain bears meters of snow above it until spring. But if you go there in April or May, you will see it emerging from beneath the snow once it has melted. as we say, "Why, where have you been? I was buried right here beneath it. And what did you do? How did you live down there?" Just as you will beneath the marble slabs where they will lay you, but one day you will rise again, just as I rose. Is this not a guarantee? Why do we bring wheat to the church? This is what the wheat teaches. Just as it rises again after it has been buried, so too will the person for whom I bring it. Though that person has been buried and the body has even decayed, one day he will rise again. It is a guarantee. It is a teaching. And if this person does not wish to accept it, do not look only at where we now stand in relation to those who came before us. Tomorrow our own descendants will stand in relation to us as we now stand to them. And we must just as we seek to leave our children something of our own, something that will help them live a little more comfortably, something they may hold up as an inheritance, above all, this is what we must leave them. Preserve this confession, "I do not die." And give instructions that these words be written on your grave: "I look for the resurrection of the dead." Not the other fairy tales people write on gravestones, with little verses and the like. What sort of things are these? And those other songs are not permitted either. Just see what season death chose to take me, now when the branches are in bloom, and the earth is putting forth grass, and other such things. These things contain neither the meaning of faith nor the meaning of the resurrection. Everything is directed toward this resurrection. If it is not to happen, tell me, what purpose does life here serve? Yet this is precisely what consoles us. There is so much tribulation in this world, so many tears, and so much evil that if there were no resurrection, there would be no reason for anyone to live here even for a single second. But this is precisely what consoles us. The resurrection consoles us. If someone reads the reasoning of the Holy Fathers appointed for the Saturday of Souls, the one we observed the day before the Sunday of the Last Judgment, he will learn a great deal there. There he will learn many things. He will learn how the dead will rise and even at what age. The fathers teach that they will rise at the age of 33. There he will learn many things concerning death and the resurrection. A person therefore needs consolation, because Satan exploits this sorrow and this natural event called death, for everything born is subject to corruption. Yet God did not make death, because God did not create death. Man together with Satan brought death into being. God did not make death, Solomon says in the first chapter. And then in the second chapter he says, through the envy of the devil, death entered into the world. So God is not to blame. And yet all these things have been set in order, and man could understand them and grasp their meaning, so that he would not live as he does, and would not be afraid. For when death comes, if he does not have a firm grasp of the truth, if he is not securely held and firmly grounded in how things truly are, he may lose his faith. And you know that many people stay away from the church for 3 whole years. You know that this happens. For 3 whole years they do not go to church. They declare war on God. "I do not agree with you about what you allowed to happen or what you did." They believe God did it, though they are mistaken. Others turn to spiritualism. They are led astray by mediums, supposedly to speak with the souls of their departed loved ones and find consolation. As though it were possible, and you understand how ridiculous and how tragic this is, as though souls could be summoned at the command of any man or woman. Yet God states clearly that no one can cross from there to here or from here to there, because a great chasm has been firmly fixed between them. If souls could move about freely, leave that place and come here to Kipsuli, where the mediums have their nest, the atmosphere there is dark, as you see, there would be no reason for anyone to remain in hell. They would simply leave and stroll around Athens. Why would they remain there? Do they receive 48-hour leave to come here, or perhaps 24-hour leave? What do those who are led astray imagine? The people have no faith. They are searching for somewhere to hold on, something to grasp. They were never counted worthy to read where they came from and what awaits them. They never went to church or listened to the funeral service, nor do they keep its text at home so that they might read it and reflect upon what human life is and what awaits us. Then there are the other charlatans. Indeed, this occurs among the upper classes, There they turn immediately to spiritualism, and the mediums supposedly put everything in order for them. Others, of course, smash plates in the cemetery and do similar things. They even put a coin in the dead person's mouth so that, they say, he can pay the toll house on his journey. Do you understand how far a believer, how far any person can fall when he lives in ignorance? All these things are the fruits of ignorance. When a person is properly grounded, he sees everything in its proper order. I remember one case. Two sisters had a father who was a serious and thoughtful man. He had firmly grounded his daughters in Christianity and had taught them well. But his final days came and he was about to die. They were expecting it from one day to the next. The two young women had arranged to receive Holy Communion on Saturday, just as we might say the day after tomorrow. But during Saturday night, their father fell asleep in the Lord. They closed the house, went to church, and received Holy Communion. When the service ended, they returned and opened the house. Then they notified the others, saying, "Our father has fallen asleep in the Lord," and they buried him on Sunday afternoon. That is true wisdom. That is profound theology and faith. Another brother, who fell asleep in the Lord a few years ago, I told you about this on another evening, had his father lying ill in the hospital in Patras. His wife and his sister had remained at the father's bedside for 15 days. One morning, after those 15 days, he was sitting in the lounge when his sister came out of the room and said, "Father has passed away. Glory to God," he said, and left. She went back into the room where the departed lay while he went away. His sister, of course, assumed he was going off somewhere to an undertaker to sort out the funeral arrangements. They lost track of him. Then his wife arrives. "Where is he? Where's Yanis?" They looked here, they looked there, Yanis here, Yanis there, and in the end they went to the house and found him fast asleep. "You're sleeping, you scoundrel," she says to him. "Father has died. Come now, my dear wife." So he died. For the 15 days he was alive, I was by his side. Now that he has died, he doesn't need anything. Let me rest a little so that I'll be able to bury him this afternoon. Otherwise, I won't be able to go to his funeral. Do we understand this? He has died. He needs no operation, no medicine, no oxygen, no doctor. He needs nothing. Sit calmly, he tells you, and make the arrangements. Where do you find such an attitude, such a way of thinking? What happens when someone dies? Where is this understanding then? It is because true faith is lacking, and so is sound knowledge of the faith and of eternal matters. Does the dead person need anything at all? Wait 5 hours, my good man? Let him remain there? What can he do to me? You are afraid of the dead, but not of the living. You need to see who can truly harm you. It is the living who will get their hands on you. Where is this wisdom, this outlook, this sure knowledge? We offer our condolences because the bereaved person is sorrowful. Should we congratulate him instead? Why congratulate him? Offer your condolences and wish that he may live to remember the departed. Stay here, live, and remember him. Do not go to join him, eh? This is precisely why people have become neurotic. This is why the psychiatric hospitals are full. And all this is because of ignorance about this serious matter, the human person's departure from this life. This must become a matter of faith for every one of us. Yet we do not even consider that we ourselves will die, and we do not want any of our loved ones to die either. Forgive me, but I was speaking with a sister, she may even be with us tonight, who was beside herself and could not face the death of her mother. My dear woman, even the Theotokos, the mother of God, yours and mine, died. What kind of thinking is this? What are these things people say? Even God, when he became man, died, and you and I are not going to die. At 33 years of age, in the prime of life, he ascended the cross. Why, for what purpose did he ascend it? And what of his venerable forerunner? They cut off his head when he was 33 or 35 years old. Who are you and I that we should not die? Stop and think deeply about this. Do not let Satan deceive you. Do not give him room and create such situations. Otherwise, those who run the funeral business will make fools of you. You consider it beneath you to prepare even a little kaliva, the memorial wheat for your husband, your child, or your father, while that whole racket over there will charge you thousands of drachmas. These are matters of unbelief, and that is why we suffer. A funeral, they tell you, costs 20,000 drachmas, 30,000 drachmas when they ought to charge you 500. How could they charge you so much? Why are you so afraid to tend to the person yourself? Where is your love? You take your loved one away for others to care for him. He is a human being, not a stranger. Is he not your own flesh and blood? Your husband, your wife, your child, your brother? Why should you recoil from such things? How squeamish have you become? Can you not even do this? It may seem cold, but it is something deeply warm and human. When you come to understand that you too will be there and will undergo the same things, for God will repay you in exactly the same way as you have treated others. These are beautiful reflections, not foolish philosophies, but beautiful reflections that leave something positive in the human soul. This, then, is the aim and concern of the entire funeral service. This is its purpose, to comfort the human person and to show him where, how, and what awaits him. The Thessalonians believed, but they could not fully grasp it in their own way. That is precisely why Paul writes his epistle to the Thessalonians. This is exactly why he writes to them, "I do not want you to grieve like the rest, who have no hope." You have heard this passage, but have you ever reflected on the meaning of this portion appointed by the church? It is taken from the fourth chapter of Paul's first epistle to the Thessalonians, at the funeral service over the departed. It is for us, it is not for the departed. It is for us. What concern is it to him? For Christ desires both to help the one who has departed and to comfort the one who remains. Christ has two hands. With one he receives the departed, and with the other he supports those left behind, provided that the person who remains is willing to lean upon him. For he does not support us by force. You should know this. You have seen, when we travel on trolleybuses and other vehicles, the handholds above us that a person can grasp, have you not? Whoever holds on will not fall, however violently the vehicle may shake, but whoever, in his pride, relies upon his own strength and balance will end up against the windshield. Take hold of me, I am here. Hold on firmly, I am here. He does not seize hold of us. We must take hold of him. You should know this. He does not hold us against our will. As long as he holds us, and as long as we cling tightly to him, to his hand, we remain utterly secure, no matter what happens or what we may hear. For if a person truly comes to terms with the fact that he will die, not only he, but all his loved ones as well, and that he may have to see them all go before him and be the last, or else go first and have the others follow after him. If he reflects deeply on this, then he realizes we have only one life and we will give it up. Then everything is resolved from that point onward. He is no longer afraid of whatever threatens him. Satan threatens the human person through death. That is why he tells him not to fast, not to have children, not to keep vigil. He tells him all these things so that he will not suffer harm and die. That is what he counts on. That is where he strikes. That is where the secret lies, because Christ came to free those held captive by the fear of death. Have you ever read the second chapter of Hebrews? Why did Christ come into the world? It says there, "Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same," and so on. Read a little further down and see why he came. That is why he came, to strengthen and comfort those whom Satan terrifies through death. Ah, my dear man, I have only one head, one life. Whether now or later, the matter has been settled. The matter has been settled. But we are afraid of death because we do not know where we are going. We are afraid because after death comes judgment, and the soul does not want to face that judgment. Why? Is everything in order? No, its record is stained. That is precisely why these things happen, why these things are said, and why all this takes place. On Tuesday, I was going to Corinth, and a taxi driver was taking me to the station so that I could catch the coach and leave. While I was in his taxi, I do not know how the conversation began, but he told me that he had just come from the cemetery in Vironis. A woman had gone there, weeping and mourning. Her husband had died 5 years earlier, and she was still weeping for him, of course. The driver and I discussed many things. He seemed to be a man of good will. But one thing struck me. For 5 years, she refused to be comforted. Yes, she refused. And this is sad, because some people use as an argument the fact that Rachel refused to be comforted. Yes, Rachel refused. No one could comfort her. Some also give the example of the Theotokos, saying that she mourned and wept and so forth. Shall we grant them even this? Those who try to use it as an argument are mistaken, because these people did not know the resurrection. Neither the Theotokos nor Rachel knew the resurrection at that moment. Besides, in that prophetic passage, Rachel herself had surely died long before those events took place. Yet the passage gathers all those children together as descendants of Rachel. That is why it says that she could not be comforted amid that great anguish and lamentation over the 14,000 infants. But the Theotokos came to know the resurrection. It was natural for her to weep for her child, especially when she saw him unjustly put to death. But we know the resurrection. There is no excuse for us. We have no excuse. I do not know whether what I have said by way of introduction can be of some help. I believe that if the subject of death were placed in its proper setting, things would be very different. In any case, Paul says, "Brethren, I do not want you to be ignorant concerning those who have fallen asleep." He says, "I do not want you to be without knowledge, not concerning those who have died, but concerning those who have fallen asleep." At once he places the matter in the setting that enables you to think correctly. "So that you may not grieve as the rest do, who have no hope. There are people who do not believe. There are people who have not come to know. Naturally, they grieve. But I do not want you to grieve as those who do not know." Now, of course, this can be understood in two ways. One may interpret it as the fathers say, "I do not want you to grieve as deeply as they do." Others make the prohibition absolute. "I do not want you to grieve in the way they grieve. You are forbidden to grieve as they do." Others add the word "so much." "I do not want you to grieve as much as they grieve." This is what we were saying about sorrow. Sorrow often drives a person even to suicide. This kind of sorrow is not right. It is not orthodox and does not belong to the faithful. Tribulation, yes. Anguish, yes, that is different. I undergo tribulation. Events cause me anguish. What has happened hems me in so tightly that I feel I have no room to move. That is human. It belongs to human nature. But the other kind is satanic. God does not desire it. So Paul says here by way of exhortation, "But we do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you grieve as the rest do, who have no hope." Many people suffer because of sorrow, and they suffer because of ignorance. But once they come to know the truth, they are set free. "So that is how it is, Father. I had thought it was otherwise." And then the person grows quiet and finds peace. This is why knowledge is essential. A person must learn how these things truly are. Once a person knows, everything changes. Paul, therefore, speaks not of those who have died, but of those who have fallen asleep. Someone who has fallen asleep calls to mind an awakening. He calls to mind the resurrection. The one who is asleep will awaken, precisely because he is sleeping. The cemeteries, what we commonly call graveyards, are one vast sleeping chamber where the departed sleep, and one day when the trumpet sounds, they will rise. This is the lesson here. Unbelievers and the ungodly have no hope. They are utterly overwhelmed. No one can comfort them. They do not know what to hold on to. Christians know where to seek consolation and where they will receive it. The others do not know where consolation can be found. Theodoret of Cyrus, one of the ancient fathers of the church who commented on this passage, says, "He does not forbid sorrow altogether. He does not tell you to rejoice, nor does he completely forbid sorrow, but he casts out its excess, the excess of someone who refuses to be comforted, who covers herself with a mourning veil or leaves a lock of hair hanging down to display her grief and affliction, and who neither eats nor drinks, neither prays nor goes to church. Thus, he does not forbid sorrow altogether, but casts out its excess and brings consolation through the hope of the resurrection. Through the resurrection, he comforts people by directing their hope toward the resurrection. This is what Paul does when he speaks of those who have fallen asleep rather than those who have died. Regarding what I told you earlier from John Chrysostom, that professional mourners and funeral lamentations and the like should be placed under excommunication because they go so far as idolatry, I have taken the following passage from one of his homilies. If anyone hires these women to mourn because they used to pay women to weep, I will bar him from the church for a long time. For a long time, he says, I will shut them out. He places them under excommunication. Treat them as pagans, because pagans they are. For if Paul calls the covetous man an idolater, how much more so the one who behaves this way at a funeral? They bring the customs of idolaters and impose what idolaters do upon a believer. We therefore forbid those lamentations ever to be introduced into the funeral processions of the faithful. And we forbid them, he says, ever again to approach the funerals of believers, lest they truly be made to mourn their own. We shall compel them to mourn their own misfortunes. Let us not force them to stay home mourning troubles of their own. He pronounces such an anathema upon them, he says, that calamity will befall their household, and they will have no opportunity to go and mourn with others, because they will be mourning their own losses. Let them take heed. The holy John Chrysostom spoke this sternly at a funeral. Yet he also wishes to console the bereaved. In that same homily, by extension, he says, what I am about to tell you, drawing attention to everything that takes place during a funeral. He speaks of the candles that are lit and carried before the procession. He speaks of the new burial shroud and the new suit placed upon the one who has fallen asleep, upon the departed. He speaks of the incense of the funeral procession and of all these things on the one hand. You show that this person is departing clothed in splendor, full of light and fragrance. But on the other hand, you weep and mourn. How can these things go together? Either send away the priests, remove the candles and the incense, cast the body aside, and sit there weeping over it, or since you make use of all these things, you cannot then turn around and say, my loved one is lost. He continues, God has crowned the one who has departed. He has freed him from suffering, delivered him from bondage, and now keeps him close to himself. He has taken him from here and keeps him with himself, and yet you mourn and weep. Are there not hymns for this? Is there not psalmody for this? All these are expressions of joy, for Scripture says, is anyone cheerful? Let him sing psalms. You should not weep, you should sing psalms. Even if you are sorrowful, but we do not have this faith within us, and that is precisely why we experience the opposite results. He continues, speaking about those who lack the hope mentioned here, and therefore grieve. The new burial garments you place upon him point beforehand to the garment of incorruption that he is to receive. The oil you pour upon him reminds you that God will be merciful to him. The incense and candles you place beside him proclaim that he has been delivered from darkness and is now in the light, and that what was once foul-smelling has now become fragrant. The sick person lying there may even smell. His wounds may have broken open here. His flesh may have decayed there, and part of his body may have been amputated, yet his soul is fragrant. This, he says, is what all the things adorning the funeral procession of the one who has fallen asleep symbolize. Therefore, when on the one hand we confess these truths, but on the other hand we lament, grieve without hope, and give ourselves over to sorrow, these things do not agree with one another. And there is also that final consolation. They lay us facing east because we await the resurrection and the coming of Christ. We are placed looking toward the east because, just as every morning we turn eastward to see the sun, so at the dawn of our resurrection we shall behold the Son of Righteousness coming from the east. All these things console a person, but if someone does not know them and does not understand what they mean, then naturally he cannot be consoled. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, here, when speaking of Christ, Paul says that he died and rose again, because he sets the resurrection over against death and mentions both. But in our case he does not speak of death, he speaks of falling asleep. Even so, through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep, not those who have died. This is the precise wording. Even so, some people still cannot grasp this. They say that they want to weep. Then let me help you, since you wish to weep, and if you can put this into practice, weep over whatever sins that person may have committed, not because you have been deprived of that person. You can do this. Perhaps I am being excessive. If 1,000 people stand mourning over one person, those 1,000 mourners do not weep for his sins. They weep because they have lost him. Not one of them weeps for his sins, not one. They all weep because that person is no longer with them. They do not weep for his sins. God is moved by tears, but by what kind of tears? Tears of unbelief, despair, and loss. No. If they are tears shed to help that person's soul, then weep. Do we have tears like that? We do not. In the Wisdom of Sirach, chapter 38, verse 16, we find the following. Those of you who have it, read it. It says, "My child, shed tears over the dead." It says to shed tears over the dead. And as one suffering grievously, begin then, if you wish, bitter weeping and ardent lamentation. Remember his judgment, remember his sin. If you insist that no one should console you and that no one should be able to comfort you, then weep for this reason. And remember this as well, such is the common lot of us all. Today we shall weep for him, tomorrow, he says, others will weep for me. But weep over his judgment and his sins, as much as you can lament his sins. Of course, tears are natural to man. You saw that even our Christ shed tears before the tomb of Lazarus. He did not tear his hair, as some would have us believe when they present this as their example. See, Christ wept. And Christ did not weep over death itself, but over our fallen state. See how I created you, and see what you have become. After all, did Christ not know that Lazarus would rise again in a little while? Could he not have made some gesture beforehand and said, "Come now, stop, you will see why there is no need to weep"? And yet he shed tears. He revealed his human nature and his compassion for mankind. He also showed that it is human to shed tears over separation. It is human, you will shed tears, you will grieve in moderation, but you must not fall into despair, you must not change the whole appearance of your house or the clothing of your family into a permanent declaration of revolt, a black flag raised against God as though saying, "God, I hold this against you for what you have done and I cannot accept it," a black plaque of protest. That is what you are really saying. And do not tell me, but what will people say? What people, who takes account of the world? Are you waiting for the world to issue you a certificate of approval? Why should it matter what people say, whatever you do? The world will have its own opinion. Woe to us if the world makes us like the Hodges oven, which everyone wanted turned in a different direction. Woe to us if the world teaches us what to wear, how to go to church, what to do, and how to believe. Woe to us if we have no character of our own. And why should we conform to the world? Why should the world not conform to us, who have the truth? Why should I be the one to make the compromise? Let the other person make that compromise and move toward salvation, rather than I make it and move toward perdition. Why? So weep, he says. Weep, but do not do what, as we see so many people do. And yet, we cannot reason with them. Indeed, one father of the church, being more condescending toward the human weakness expressed in tears, writes somewhere that he once saw an ox lose its mate under the yoke, and even the ox, the animal, shed tears. He puts it this way concerning the animal. "I myself saw even an ox shed tears when it was once separated from its mate. The animal," he says, "wept." The natural feelings are one thing, as I often say, when you have a tooth pulled, your tongue keeps searching for it for a month. It keeps going back to that spot. Someone is missing from the company. Someone is missing from the family. That is natural. Look, this is where he used to sit. Look, this is what we used to say. We may say, "Do you remember what a good life we had together?" Yes, you may do that. But you must not raise a black flag, break off your relationship with God, and then receive condolences, from whom, who is able to console you? Every corrupt man and woman comes to offer condolences. Ask them what boldness they have before Christ that would enable them to console you. What gives someone that ability? Merely because he is a relative? What relationship does he have with God so that he can comfort you? Who among them can truly remember you before God? No one. Yet as a mere formality, we go to the memorial service and ask, will they be there? Madam, where are you going to present yourself and before whom? Where is that soul? Does your relative possess it? It is in the hands of God. Have you brought yourself into harmony with God? Have you united your will with His? Have you confessed? Do you believe in Him so that you may go and intercede? Are you truly among those invited by the funeral notice to come and unite your prayers with theirs for the repose of their departed loved one? Yet you stay outside strolling around while the divine liturgy is being celebrated inside, and you say, I came for the memorial service, I did not come for the liturgy. You came for the memorial service, and who is to perform that memorial service? Is it not Christ, who has authority over both the dead and the living and reigns even over death? Yet you have no relationship with Him. You simply come to have the sweet and the cognac and to say, may they live to remember the departed. Ah, woe to you, and woe also to those who invited you and are waiting for your help. So, should we not invite our relatives? We should not invite our relatives in order to receive help from them. You should invite them so that you may help them, and perhaps they too may see where they can find rest. Invite them, I am not saying that you should not. But do not expect help from them, because they do not know Christ who holds the soul of the departed. You should invite people, as the blessed John Chrysostom says, whether they are elderly or young people who are religious and have the strength to say, my God, judge mercifully, yes, invite such a person, so that perhaps he may reflect that one day he too will be there. Perhaps he may hear a talk by some priest on these matters, that we too will depart this life and hear, prepare yourselves, gentlemen. Perhaps he will hear something and be edified. Will you invite him? No, for fear of being misunderstood. There can be no misunderstanding about this. These are lies we tell ourselves. You will invite someone in order that he may be benefited, not so that he may benefit you. This is what the saints teach. Saint Basil the Great answers, those who say that Christ shed tears and treat this as a binding precedent. Saint Basil the Great says, the tear of the Lord did not establish a law commanding mourning. Through His tear, Christ did not command people to lament. The Lord's tear was not a law commanding us to mourn, but a most fitting measure set before us, and a precise rule showing how we ought, with dignity and proper restraint, to remain within the bounds of human nature. As a human being, you grieve when someone dear to you departs from this life. You are deprived of a beloved person, a good fellow worker. And so grief comes over you. How will you replace him? Whom will you put in that place? And the passage goes on like this. Nor is it permitted to men to be lovers of mourning and given to many tears. I do not allow this sort of thing, he says. There is something else here that offers consolation, and I would like to tell you about it. It is found in Psalm 40, verse 9. In verse 9, David says this, shall not he who sleeps rise again? Why does everyone speak of death? Here it says, he who sleeps not as people understand it. Even then, this expression was already being used. This was under the law in David's time, 1,000 years before Christ. Shall not he who sleeps rise again? Will not the one who sleeps also be called to rise, he says, to awaken? Why then should you grieve? If you say to me, David says the following, whether in the Old Testament or the New Testament, where does the law or Holy Scripture ever speak of the dead by saying that the person has vanished and everything is lost? Where is such a thing ever said? Saint Photios the Great, that pillar of orthodoxy, has a relevant passage on this, which I shall relate to you. When Paul speaks about Christ, he calls his death, death. When he speaks of Christ, he says he died and rose again. But when he speaks of our own departure, he calls our death sleep. He does not call it death. In the same passage, he mentions the departure of human beings 3 times, and nowhere does he call it death, but always sleep. He calls it sleep in order to soothe the pain and bring comfort in the face of this separation. For the one who sleeps will surely rise again, since death is nothing other than a long sleep. For us, the sun sleeps for 12 hours and then rises again. It rises again, the seed remains beneath the earth for 5 or 6 months, and then it rises again. How many times have we ourselves died and risen again? Is not our sleep a kind of death in every respect? And is not our waking a resurrection? Where are you when you sleep? Are you alive or are you dead? Someone will say, I am alive, and I believe it. The soul also remains alive, yet you hear nothing. Someone could rob you because you are in your deepest sleep. I come in through the window and take your trousers, and in the morning you are playing Adam for me. Good heavens, why can't you hear? How can you be awake? Are you dead? Then how are you breathing? I behold a strange and wondrous mystery. The man who has fallen asleep there is living, though dead, and you too are living, though dead when you sleep. You wake when your alarm clock rings, and he, when the trumpet sounds like an alarm clock, will also awaken, whether we want it or not. It is utterly absurd, completely illogical, and deeply harmful for anyone not to believe that the dead are merely asleep. Here St. Photios the Great says that death is nothing other than a long sleep. Well, how many years does it last? Who knows? Abimelech slept for 70 years beneath the fig tree, and when he awoke after 70 years, he rubbed his head. He had a slight headache. The young man woke up. He woke up quickly, even though he had slept for 70 years. Baruch slept for 70 years. The seven youths under Decius slept for 350 years. Then they awoke in broad daylight and went down to the marketplace to buy bread. And when they tried to spend coins that had been in circulation 350 years earlier, they were arrested and taken before the judge, who asked where they had found them. Where did we find them? They said. These are ancient coins. You must have found them somewhere. Then it was revealed that they had been asleep in the cave for 350 years, so that the justice of God might be vindicated. God's justice, how can this be? It belongs to God. Does it cost anything for Him to raise us? From what materials did God make us in the first place? Which of us lent Him anything? And now that He even has the remains of what has fallen apart, will He not be able to fashion man anew when He has the bones and the material itself? Did the clever, the wise, and the scientist provide these things? Is He unable to make man? Alas for us, in any case, the passage continues. So also God will bring with Him those who have fallen asleep through Jesus. Christ is the one who will raise those who have fallen asleep and take them with Him, presenting them before God. Therefore, your own loved one who is sleeping now. We do not know how long he will sleep, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years. We do not know when the second coming will take place, nor when the resurrection will occur. Christ will raise him also. The issue is not that a person has died. The issue is how that person will die and in what spiritual condition he will be found when death comes. That is what is dreadful. That is what is fearful. We shall all taste the cup of death. The question is how we shall be found, because the earth will give back whatever was entrusted to it for safekeeping on the day of death. Good works to the resurrection of life. Unbelief and worship of the flesh to the resurrection of judgment. This is what you gave me. Our graves will be opened, whether we want it or not. When I open your graves, then you shall know that I am the Lord. And Christ came and opened the tombs, revealing his divinity and proving that he is the Lord, and he will open them again on the day of judgment, when some will be given eternal life. As we heard the day before yesterday in the Gospel of the Judgment, and others eternal hell. This is why some see an elder, others an old person, and still others someone of another age. From the age of 7, a person must be deeply concerned that he may die, and must consider how he will die. From 7 years old, he is accountable for sin. From the age of 7, therefore, he must go to confession and prepare himself. He is not without responsibility. Indeed, some fathers place the age even lower, at 5. A child's responsibility depends on the degree of understanding possessed by his nous, his spiritual intellect. That is why the Church does not leave little children off the lists of names commemorated for the departed. It includes them as well, for they too have sinned, even if in ignorance. Ignorance. That is why Ecclesiastes says to the young, yes, while you are young, put on your hat, go your way, and follow the desires of your flesh as you please. But know that one day God will bring you to judgment. He will call you to account. Ignorance is no excuse. Even the world and its laws do not accept ignorance as an excuse. You cannot go to the president and say to him, Mr. President, I did not know that. God does not accept ignorance of his law as an excuse. Man is obliged to know it. Therefore, we must not call someone blessed merely because he died young. If he did not die young in Christ, if he did not die honorably, repentant, having confessed and fasted as God desires, his youth does not save him, for as you know, there is no salvation merely by works. For this reason, the fear of God must also be taught to the younger ones and to young people generally. Older women must not encourage young girls by saying, she is young now. If she does not do these things now, when will she? In other words, if she is not corrupted now, when will she be corrupted? When she is old and no one looks at her. Why do some women say such things? They excuse these failings and yield to them, when instead they ought to admonish the young and remind them what they may suffer if death comes unexpectedly, and they have no time for metanoia, repentance, and holy confession. This isn't some open pasture where anyone can wander in and trample around as they please. Every single person will come to judgment and will hang by their own foot. They won't hang by mine, and I won't hang by anyone else's. As the folk saying goes, every lamb hangs by its own leg. Many mothers have seen their children appearing darkened, even though they died young. They have seen their children blackened because they failed to strengthen and instruct them in the true faith and failed to sanctify them from childhood through the mysteries, attendance at church, fasting, and everything else. They simply let them loose, saying, we shall deal with it when they grow up. But once someone has left the track, is it so easy for him to return to it and travel safely toward eternity? Here the passage clearly states that Christ will raise mankind and bring them before God the Father. Paul also speaks of this in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians. We should now bring in that passage, but it opens up a large subject, and if we begin it now, it will be cut off halfway through, and its meaning will not be presented as it should be. So please allow me to stop here this evening, and God willing, we shall continue next time.